Chief, the judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. The court is called to order. The court calls the case of United States versus Second Lieutenant David W. Bruno, miscellaneous docket number 2017-03. Under Article 62, Uniform Code of Military Justice, the government presents the following issue for consideration. Whether the military judge erred by excluding evidence of appellee's reinspection year analysis. Government counsel, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 5 minutes.
Very well, you may proceed.
Thank you. Senior Judge Johnson, Senior Judge Mayberry, Judge Franzo, may it please the court. I, Major Tyler Musselman, and with me is Colonel Catherine Oliver, together we represent the United States in this proceeding. The military judge held the government to an erroneous heightened burden of proof in this case. What's more, her ruling demonstrates erroneous views of the law regarding what constitutes an order, how discrepancies in a year analysis process are to be evaluated, and the impact or how to evaluate whether or not there was consistency in enforcement. Due to these errors, the military judge failed to identify that the second year analysis in this case was conducted as an incident of command. As a result, reversal of the military judge's ruling suppressing appellee's second positive year analysis is necessary. The overarching question in this case is, was the second year analysis conducted as an incident of command, the primary purpose of which was to ensure security, military fitness, and good order and discipline? I think in this case we're focused on the first portion of that question. Was the second year analysis conducted as an incident of command? Now to me that breaks down into two points. Looking at the command authority, in other words, what was the command authority at play? And the second part of that issue or question is connecting that command authority to the year analysis. And you sort of see that in Miller, when they say this tie or connection between inspection and command authority is important in justifying the reasonableness of what otherwise was a wanton search. Now those are the two portions of the initial question. I think there's a third point, which is how do we resolve any discrepancies in carrying out the policy? To address the first portion, the command action or the authority in this instance, for that I direct this court to the commander's policy memo, the wing commander, who has the authority to test those under his command. Most importantly, if you look at the memorandum at the top, it states Memorandum 4, and it says all military personnel tested under authority of the Barksdale Air Force Base Drug Demand Reduction Program. It does not say memorandum for squadron commanders. It does not say memorandum for group commanders. It's directed at members tested under the Barksdale Air Force Base Drug Testing Program, members like appellee. Of course, the first and second paragraphs support this idea that the memo is, the policy is directive in nature towards those tested. This policy, this memorandum outlines my policy requiring military personnel to report for year analysis reinspection following a positive year analysis. These year analysis inspections are part of my random year analysis program. The memorandum is directed at members and it requires them to retest. It's not just simply an order to squadron commanders to order their members to retest. It's directive in nature, and it dictates that members like appellee who test positive are to retest.
So did the appellee have a duty to self-report, given that he fell within the program?
Well, I think that would go to knowledge, whether he had knowledge of the order. It's not a general order or regulation, and so he would have to have knowledge of the policy. I don't know that we have any information in that regard.
If it were a general order, would he have a duty?
Yes, and Your Honor, I wouldn't say that it's a duty to self-report. It's a duty to report to a certain location for inspection. For instance, if somebody in their in-processing package were to show up to an installation for a training class and they were to report to Building 100 for an initial year analysis inspection upon reporting to training, they would have a duty to do so. And I think the memorandum in this case dictates it as well. But, so I think that it could be accomplished by that means, but also it could be carried out by the squadron or the commander as necessary.
It's the policy memo that gives the command authority. That's where we're looking at incident of command, and it comes from this letter. The squadron commander's role in this is merely to get the person to the doorstep. That's what the notification is about. You know that's the case because ask yourself in this case, had the squadron commander give a written order, what would have changed?
What would have changed?
Yes, what would have changed, Your Honor?
Of an order? So you don't believe the actual issuance of an order would change the facts in this case?
No, Your Honor. It would have led to appellee being taken to DDR and submitting a urine analysis test.
In accordance with the order?
Well, in accordance with a squadron commander's order or in accordance with the policy memorandum. And that's another point I'd like to point out. Incident of command, there's nothing that requires that a member be actually issued an order for it to be a valid inspection. And a hypothetical, for example, is if the wing commander states that on Wednesday, every fifth military member coming through the gate, his vehicle will be inspected. If a colonel shows up to the gate and they're the fifth car and the senior airman says, sir, we're conducting an inspection, we need to inspect your vehicle. The policy's not given to them, no one issues them the order. The colonel gets out and his or her car is inspected. That's an inspection. The previous example I'd given, if someone shows up to a training class, or a dorm-based search. If a commander issues an order that his first sergeant and chief are to go inspect a dorm room in a training environment, even if some of the trainees aren't there, they don't have to be provided that order. They can go into the dorm bay and search it. So there's no order that has to be given to the member that's being inspected. And I think that's sort of how the military judge got in trouble, was looking for that specific order. What we have there is a commander's intent for an inspection, and that's the wing commander. People that test positive are to be reinspected. So you have a policy there. The second question is not, did the member receive a direct order, or how was it formatted? It's, did the person, was the whatever happened as a result of that policy? In other words, the wing commander issues a reinspection order. Was the person's presence at DDR because of that policy? I think that's the question that needs to be asked. That's how you know that it was incident command. And I draw that from a couple of different sources. If you look at this court's opinion in Attic, which I believe was cited in my colleague's brief, 64 MJ 518, the appellant in that case did not receive an order from his commander, but a memorandum from his first sergeant that says, you need to go take your analysis. The second to last conclusory paragraph of this court is important because it identifies what's important. That the commander had intended that all of his members as part of an inspection were to undergo your analysis testing, that he had issued a verbal order to other members, but not to the appellant, that the taking of appellant's your analysis sample was part of that inspection, and that the inspection met the requisites of Military Rule of Evidence 313B. In other words, what important was the commander intended an inspection, and then the member was there because of that inspection. You sort of see this in Muhammad, which is an unpublished case, but it was appended to our brief. This court noted that in that case, there was an issue of whether or not the commander had just signed these orders before knowing that the member had been selected. What was important and what was emphasized was the military judge's key finding in that case was that the appellant was properly required to submit to an inspection. In other words, in that case, that they had been selected, and that the commander's role, the squadron commander's role in that process was merely one of notification. There was no ability to say yes or no on the inspection. There was no discretion to be used by the squadron commander.
What if the OSI agent had not known about the policy, but told them to take him to DDR anyway?
Then I think we'd have an issue. Because at that question, it becomes a real question at that point is whether or not this is just a continuation of the OSI search. And I think that brings up an important point, Your Honor, is what is this if it's not an inspection? So I think your options are a subterfuge or a consent search. And I don't think that the evidence shows in any shape or form that this is a sort of subterfuge. Given the OSI agent's testimony, the military judge didn't make that finding. And the military judge stated the member didn't consent, didn't want to be there. Well, if the member didn't consent, how did he get there? He got there because he was taken there by his unit, who on the way, and this is the military judge's finding of fact, advised the squadron commander that there was a wing policy that required reinspection. The squadron commander acknowledged they were on their way. There was no reason to issue another order because the wing commander's policy was being carried out. That's how you explain the military judge's finding that there was no consent. There was no consent, so the question is, how did he get there? And he was directed to go there. But really, the question is simply, was he there as a result of the wing commander's policy?
Counsel, let me just back you up a little bit. The case law talks about this re-inspection as being a continuance of the original inspection under the drug policy, the Air Force drug policy, correct?
Your Honor, it's a re-inspection of the initial random, which was conducted under 90-507.
Right, and 90-507 requires the initial test. You get notified. And there's a process for that, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
A written document that is given to each and every Air Force member that has been randomly selected to test?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that happened in this case?
On the initial random inspection, yes, Your Honor.
And the commander's policy here, the installation commander's policy, says that the member will be notified in accordance with 9507?
Yes, Your Honor.
But it's your position that that doesn't actually require notification in accordance with 9507?
Our assertion is that it doesn't equate to suppression in this case. And for that premise, we point this court to Beckett, Pollard, Strozer, Bickel, and this court's decision in Streetman. And administrative, this is Streetman. And in that case, it was... the second order in Streetman that had been given to the reservist appellant stated command directed at the top. This court held an administrative error or even a mistaken labeling of an otherwise valid inspection will not serve to invalidate that inspection or to change its character. When you look at cases like Beckett, Pollard, Strozer, and Bickel, what you see is discrepancies. The courts have identified discrepancies in policies or regulations that actually matter. And those are discrepancies that go to the reliability, the collection, or the processing of a urine sample. The discrepancy we have here is merely one of notification. It's an error like in Streetman mislabeling of the notification letter. Once again, nothing would have changed. In other words, there's no defense counsel hasn't challenged the reliability of the results or anything of that nature. Had the written order been given, appellee would have ended up at the same place, and the same test would have been given.
You had stated that the wing commander's policy was being carried out. You just also acknowledged that the requirements set forth in the policy weren't followed. So who was carrying out the policy, and how was the policy being carried out?
Well, Your Honor, by policy, I mean the commander's inspection policy, that people that test positive are required to retest. That's the command of inspection authority. In other words, the commander has stated that people that test positive are required to retest for the purposes of good order and disciplining military necessity. And that's the command authority. The portion that was a discrepancy in this case was merely one of process, getting the appellee to the door. And so, like I said before, you go from the command authority to the retest, and you have to make a connection for that. And the connection from that comes from the military judge's own findings, that the OSI agent knew of the policy and made a habit of telling, first sergeants that didn't have a lot of practice in this field what the policy was. Then you have them driving, based on OSI's information, driving appellee to DDR. On the way there, the squadron commander getting a call. While they're on their way to DDR, there's a wing policy, it requires reinspection, we're accomplishing it.
And after he's the subject of the criminal investigation in an interview with OSI, OSI agents who are armed with information that suggests he committed criminal activity.
Well, I guess, Your Honor, the answer to that would be, would it have made any difference if they told him or they just handed him the commander's policy letter?
Well, they didn't. No one was aware of the policy except OSI, correct?
Right, Your Honor, but once again, I think that it's just informing the person of the policy and then they comply with it. I don't see that it makes this a search in any way. It just drags us back to the inspection. I think that informing them of what the contents or the requirements of the policy letter is, as far as a reinspection is required, vice handing it to them, I don't think there's a significant difference there for the purpose of that question. Once again, I just harken back to the squadron commander getting a phone call that his people are on the way there because of the wing commander's policy and him acknowledging and understanding that. By policy, I mean the requirement that somebody retest. And so, based on that information, that's why he was at DDR. I think that demonstrates that. Once again, especially when we're talking about preponderance of the evidence for the overall question in this case, vice the clear and convincing burden of proof, which was one of the legal errors made by the military judge. But I think that the evidence in and of itself shows the reason he was there was because of the policy. There is no other explanation for it, and the circumstances, the evidence, the testimony, and the findings by the military judge support that. And I think that's all this court needs to get to. I don't think there has to be a direct order for something to be an inspection. And you see Miller, when you look at what was absent in Miller compared to what is present in this case, that's, you can get your answer there too. In Miller, there was no command policy. And CAF uses the word policy letter, directive, or order. In other words, it doesn't have to be a direct order. They just talk about a command policy, and I harken back to inspections at the gate or a dorm bay inspection. It's the command directs someone, or there's a command policy, and it has to do with an inspection. In this case, it's retesting.
But in this case, the policy says that the commander will order. So it's not like Miller where we don't have a policy letter. Here we have a policy letter, and the policy letter explicitly says the process involves an order. But do I understand you in saying that as long as there's a policy, the implementation of that policy falls outside the scope of whether or not that your analysis is in fact an inspection? Because it's intended to be an inspection. This policy is designed for it to be an inspection, and regardless of how it's carried out, it still amounts to an inspection.
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say regardless of how it's carried out. I think the way to look at this is, did the policy mandate that those that test positive are required to retest? And the answer to that is yes. When you look at it, an appellee met the criteria as found by the military judge, so he was required to retest. Then you look at the impact of what impact a discrepancy from whatever portion of that policy, what impact actually was that? What happened? And when you look at it, the only thing it would have added was a piece of paper. Because he got to DDR, they had been informed of the policy, that's why they were there, and he submitted the inspection. When you look at the sort of discrepancies that would support suppression, they have to do with things like reliability, collection, processing. And once again, that comes with Strozer and Pollard and Bickle. You see the evolution through those cases that we've cited. The ultimate determination in the context of deviation from testing regulations is whether under Pollard there had been a substantial violation of regulations intended to assure reliability of the testing procedures. That's not the case here. The defense has not challenged the ultimate, what was done at DDR. And I know it's a simplistic way of looking at it, but it was just to get him to the door. That's what and you think about the practicality of it, right? It's the squadron commander who gets the notification. So he's going to be the one to know. The member's not going to know that he or she tested positive. So it's likely the wing commander put that in there because the squadron commander is the one that can ensure that the policy, the mandate, the requirements carried out. And just to be clear for this court, our primary argument is the policy letter in this case is a mandate, it is an order, it is a requirement to the member. In the alternative, even if this court finds it is not, it is just an order to the squadron commander. it's still a valid inspection because the command authority at issue in this case is the command authority of the wing commander who has established that, you know, squadron commander is not the one that established that your analysis, if you test positive, you have to retest. It comes from the wing commander in this case. And then the connection is there through the findings of fact by the military judge. And the discrepancies involved, I agree that it's not clean, and if there had been a letter, we wouldn't be sitting here. But the law doesn't require it to be perfect. And you see that in this Streetman when it's, you know, administrative errors won't support suppression, and then it's really defined in those cases like Strohs or Pollard and Whipple. Now, I touched on in my intro errors by the military judge and legal errors by the military judge, and I think that's how she arrived at the incorrect decision, looking at it through the wrong lens. And I don't, you know, and that's why I don't think we have to look for an absolute order in this case. But I think the burden of proof was incorrect. It should not have been clear and convincing. And that's the lens with which an individual applies the facts to the legal questions in the case. Her whole analysis is sectioned between two portions that say the government did not show by clear and convincing evidence. The government failed to meet its burden of clear and convincing evidence that the collection and drug testing was accomplished as part of a lawful inspection. The government has failed to show by clear and convincing evidence there was an inspection ordered by one authority. And that gets to my next point. I think the military judge had an erroneous view of what constitutes an order. I think that's a legal question. Obviously, the lawfulness of an order is reviewed de novo. What's communicated, I think, is a factual question, but whether it's an order is a different one. And I don't think it's mandatory for this court to go into it for the purposes of this question, but if it feels the need, Captain CV ordered Apelli to DDR and ordered him to stay there until he submitted a sample. An order is merely a mandate with specific acts by one with authority that relates to a military duty. Captain CV was a superior commissioned officer, therefore he had the authority to issue orders to those underneath him. He was also a fill-in flight commander and supervisor.
Did he have the authority under the commander's policy letter?
I would say yes, based on the idea that subordinates can carry out, in certain circumstances, the responsibilities of their higher level commanders. But I don't think we necessarily have to, like I said, we can detach ourselves as far as whether an order is required, but even if we don't, I think the phone call where the squadron commander is told we're going there because of the wing's policy memorandum and he acknowledges and says okay covers that issue. As far as the remainder of the legal errors, and the erroneous view of the order, I think, is also what led to discounting the policy letter. You see the military judge compared the policy or the idea of a standing order by a wing commander to Gaetano, the idea that it's that would just equate to a computer issuing an order. And you can see that on page 7 in paragraph 46 of her ruling. But the reason that this is different, reason that, and she didn't tie it to the plain language of the memo. The reason this is different from Gaetano is we're not missing here what we missed in Gaetano, which is here this is an entirely different situation because we have a policy letter or policy memorandum. In Gaetano, it was the initial random inspection, so that had to be tied to some sort of command authority. And you see that in the court's discussion as far as when it was in order. Gaetano is also entirely distinguishable here because of the question of Gaetano. Anything this court does in this case is not going to impact the decision in Gaetano in any way. The issue in Gaetano was a narrow one, and that's under the paragraphs of 44-120, when is a member ordered so that they can no longer self-ID. That's different from the case we have here because we're on a follow-on Bickelier analysis in a court underneath a commander's policy memo. Although it's tied to the random inspection initially, what directed the reinspection is a command authority in the form of a policy memo. So I think it divorces this case from Gaetano.
So at what point was the defendant in this case legally obligated to submit to the examination?
When results were received that he tested positive. As far as when that was communicated to him, that's a different question. So I guess legally obligated would be when it's communicated to him. Because it's not a general order, you're right, Your Honor. So if he doesn't have knowledge, I mean, I think there's one thing, the existence of the requirement and the knowledge. If he didn't know the policy letter existed, then he'd be obligated when he was informed of his responsibility, which was after his OSI interview. As far as the remainder of the legal errors, the deviation from policy, the judge seemed to have a very narrow, strict view of what deviations would lead to suppression. Obligated to follow his policy as he expressed it. Well, under Pollard, Strozer, and Bickel, that's not the case. Deviations can be accepted as long as they don't impact the reliability of testing. And finally, consistent enforcement. There was never a question of whether or not some members had been required a Bickel test and others hadn't. And I see I'm out of time. If this court has no further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Captain Alan Abrams, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Nicholas McHugh, I represent the appellee, Second Lieutenant David Bruno. The authority to order inspections belongs solely to commanders, not law enforcement or anyone else. In this case, the prosecution failed to meet its burden to show the exercise of lawful command authority, and the military judge should be affirmed for two reasons. First, the drug testing program was carried out on autopilot, resulting in urine being seized from Lieutenant Bruno unlawfully at the direction of law enforcement, not as an incident to command. Second, the government's after-the-fact rebranding of the examination as an inspection doesn't fit with court decisions directing that commanders must follow the specific mandates they set for themselves. Now, in this particular case, my colleague for the government talked about how the heck did we end up getting this sample taken from Lieutenant Bruno if there was no order, if none of these things were done. Well, in this case, the record makes clear there really was no order from anyone. Paragraph 17 of Appellate Exhibit 20 of the military judge's ruling, she found that Lieutenant Colonel Arcane never ordered that Lieutenant Bruno to give it any sort of urine sample in this case. That's well supported by the government's concession at page 103 and 104 of the transcript. Likewise, Captain C.V. testifies on his own. He never gave an order. That's found by the military judge in paragraph 15 of the ruling, and is well supported by his testimony at page 138 of the transcript. Likewise, Special Agent J.R. says he lacked the authority to give any order. So we are left with this question that my colleague for the government did pose of how did we end up doing this. The reason that we wound up with an examination here in this case is because we had a urine inspection program that was conducted on autopilot, the exact fear that the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces expressed in 2008 in the Miller case. And we see, and that left a void here where law enforcement ultimately stepped in. That's something that's not allowed under Military Rule of Evidence 313A, where it makes clear that inspections are an incident to command. Likewise, that's echoed in U.S. v. Miller and again in U.S. v. Ayala in 2010. Where again, the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces was considering, is this something that is a subterfuge for law enforcement, the reinspection letter in that case, or is it the commander truthfully exercising their authority to check the readiness of their command? Here, it's troublesome because at page 6 of their reply brief, the government emphasizes the military judge's finding that the examination conducted in this case was, quote, at the direction of law OSI. That's a fact that the government should be distancing itself from, not embracing fully. That finding by the military judge is well-founded, again, by the record, and again, we come back to this issue that my colleague posed, which is how did we wind up having this Lieutenant Bruno go and take this examination? We get that here and get light shed on that by Captain CV's testimony, where he talks again and again and again and again in the record. And we see it also in his sworn statement, which is attached to Appellate Exhibit 8 in the record, that what happened here was, to his understanding, quote, part of the process. We see that phrase over and over and over again from Captain CV. So it's necessary to peel back the layers of what is the process that Captain CV is talking about. Now, at one point, he seems to express an opinion that even he thinks is part of an investigative process. That's around page 138, I think, of the record. Ultimately, he says that's not what OSI told me. But nonetheless, he even puts that out there. To understand what process Captain CV is talking about, it's necessary to really go back to the outset of what happened when Lieutenant Colonel R.K. first learns that Lieutenant Bruno has tested positive. So Lieutenant Colonel R.K., he finds out that Lieutenant Bruno has tested positive, and then he does what we would expect commanders to do, especially a new commander who's just been in the seat for a few weeks. He calls his legal advisor. He says, legal advisor, what do I do? And we get this at paragraph 11 of the military judge's ruling, as well as pages 124 and 125 of the transcript. Lieutenant Colonel R.K., he calls his legal office, and they tell him, go call OSI. Go call OSI. Specifically, what he says is, I think we talked about general procedures when you have a positive urine analysis test and just kind of what the next steps were for that. And I believe that's where I was recommended that I called OSI because I remember hanging up the phone with legal and looking up the number for OSI and calling OSI. Now, it's telling that what is missing from Lieutenant Colonel R.K.'s testimony there is he doesn't say, the legal office told me about the wing commander's policy. He doesn't say, they told me Lieutenant Bruno is going to have some examination. And we know that also because Captain CV, in his testimony, he says, I never learned, I didn't even think that I was going to have to take Lieutenant Bruno to the drug testing lab until OSI told us. If Lieutenant Colonel R.K. knew that and he learned that from the legal office, he would pass that on to Captain CV and Master Sergeant CM. So Lieutenant Colonel R.K., he gets this information, and then Captain CV, he takes Lieutenant Bruno over. And then Lieutenant Bruno is questioned for 50 minutes by OSI in violation of his Article 31 rights, and that's established by Appellate Exhibit 9, which is not challenged in this appeal. The military judge's ruling suppressing those statements. And what's important here, I'd point the court to paragraph 14 of the military judge's ruling there, because she finds that Lieutenant Bruno asks the agent specifically, what's the process? What's going to happen now? And Special Agent JR tells him, here's the process. You're going to go to booking, and then you're going to go give a urine analysis. He doesn't say, it's the wing commander's policy that you're going to give a urine analysis, but that's something for your command to take care of. He just characterizes it as the next step that's going to follow before he's released for the day. And part of his rationale for that, and part of his response to Lieutenant Bruno's question about, well, am I under arrest? What's going to happen? He says, no. He says, okay, so as a military member, in custody, essentially. So he characterizes it basically as, you have no option here about what's going to happen to you, Lieutenant Bruno. And then Special Agent JR reiterates that again, because he brings Lieutenant Bruno out to where Captain CV and Master Sergeant CM are, and this is from Captain CV's testimony. We see it at page 19 in his testimony and again at page 30 of his testimony in the transcript. And it's OSI comes out. At page 19, Captain CV says OSI, quote, directed us that we would go straight to drug demand and reduction and have him take a urine analysis. And again at page 30, where Captain CV makes clear that Lieutenant Bruno is now present for this, he says the agent just said, quote, that we needed to take him to drug demand and reduction for urine analysis. It's not that there's a policy and here's what's going to happen. It's just that this is going to happen.
But didn't the judge find that the OSI agent was, in fact, aware of the policy?
He's aware that there was a policy, Your Honor. Yes, the military judge did find that he knew that there was a policy.
So there was a policy that required him to go for another urine analysis that the OSI agent was aware of.
But not necessarily that it required Lieutenant Bruno to go, Your Honor. I mean, there's a number of pieces that are set out within the policy memorandum beyond just the requirement for retesting. But at the end of the day, yes, Your Honor, the Special Agent JR knew of the policy. What's important to note, though, with the policy, Your Honor, is the policy is dated 7 June 2016. Now, Special Agent JR, he's been on approximately 40, by his estimation, drug cases. He's been an OSI agent for close to 5 years. He may not have been paying attention to exactly what this policy requires and all the details that are set out in it, including paragraph 4. He doesn't characterize any of those to Captain CV or Master Sergeant CM. In fact, we really don't know anything about what Master Sergeant CM understood because he was never presented by the government for testimony. But nonetheless, so we get this testimony from Special Agent JR that here's what I could have done and should have done and would have done, because to the best of my memory, I don't remember exactly what I said, but I do remember, but what I would have said is, hey, there's just this policy and you need to go by it. Regardless of him telling him, even if we assume that Special Agent JR just said, there is this policy that needs to be abided by, it's still not a role that law enforcement needs to be taking. Command needs to take the stick back from law enforcement. That's why we have Military Rule of Evidence 313. That's perhaps why the installation commander has all these additional requirements set out in his policy memorandum. That is for the command to do that. So even if we take this back, the government found so important in terms of Captain CD being informed of the policy and then Lieutenant Colonel RK being informed that they're doing this in accordance with the policy from paragraph 17 from the military judge's ruling, it's incumbent then on the command to say, what policy? I didn't know there was a policy. Let me go find out.
So what if they asked that question? What discretion do they have? The subordinate commanders under this policy.
The discretion that they have, Your Honor?
If any.
Their discretion is limited under the policy, but they still have an obligation to act under the policy. And that's an important distinction here, because that's exactly what the installation commander has elected to say that they have to do. It's up to the installation commander who sets the policy to set his own requirements. If we're just carrying out a policy without knowing what it says, then we're in the exact problem that Miller seems to be concerned with, where they're talking about a policy that's being carried out on autopilot. Here in this case, in all the cases that we also have relevant to all these inspection cases, and Miller, for example, is not a re-inspection case. It's just a regular, the initial notification inspection, but yet it refers to Bickel. So these cases are all relevant to each other. In Bickel, Ayala, Miller, and Catano, all of those cases, the court placed close attention to what did the commander say about whether something is ordered, and was that followed?
Well, then in the court in Ayala said that the answer to this question turns on the purpose of the examination, correct?
Your Honor, let me clarify a little bit with Ayala, because Ayala, you're right, is not exactly about the order itself. It was more concerned with the purpose of the policy memorandum. That was really the issue, because the defense in that case wasn't challenging the order so much as the purpose of the installation commander's policy. Ayala is informative in this sense. In Ayala, the court looked closely at what was the installation commander's intent. What did he have to say on this topic? So they looked carefully and the court paid close adherence to what the installation commander had to say. In that particular case, it was expressed not just in the policy memorandum from the commander, but also in the form of his affidavit. Here in this case, the only evidence that we have about what the installation commander expected for his drug testing program is found really in two places. It's one in the policy memorandum itself, all page and a half of it, and then we have the testimony from Special Agent J.R., whose testimony, when cross-examined by the trial defense counsel, says the policy memorandum says what it means and means what it says. He didn't challenge anything to do with the policy memorandum. He, in fact, reinforced exactly what is in the language of the entirety of the policy memorandum. And
but
that's an important distinction.
Isn't the policy memorandum clear, though? Doesn't it clearly say that on a non-discretionary basis, individuals who test positive will submit to another urinalysis? And then in a separate paragraph, it identifies that the unit commander will issue an order directing them to do so.
It does say both of those things, Your Honor, yes. And none of the cases that we have about whether an order is given or whether we're complying with any sort of commander's policy, specifically Bickel, Miller, and Catano, say, look at what is otherwise relevant language to the issue at hand and then disregard it, which seems to be the position that the government is taking here. They seem to be taking the position that, yes, paragraph 4 is relevant, it's on point, but it doesn't matter. And that's not supported by any one of those cases.
What about the argument that the point of that provision is to make sure that the commander's intent gets effectuated by the unit? In other words, the point is to make sure the individual who is required to go for another urinalysis actually gets over there and gives another urinalysis sample.
That degree of the commander's intent isn't fleshed out in the record, Your Honor. All we have in the record is what's in the policy memorandum. So the prosecution could have called the installation commander, certainly. They could have called people who were familiar with the drug testing program. They could have called Master Sergeant CN. They could have called any number of people who could have shed some light exactly to your question, but they didn't hear. And there's no affidavit even from the installation commander, even though this litigation carried out over a number of days. That's just not in the record. So all we have is really that the installation commander's intent was evidently that he thought that paragraph 4 was necessary to carrying out exactly what he wanted here, and that was not complied with. And there, it's interesting also how this it lines up in terms of a timeline with Catano, because in this case, in that case, this court addressed what does it mean to have a year analysis ordered. And it talked about the importance of compliance with Air Force Instruction 9507. And in the installation commander's policy here, he talks about compliance with Air Force Instruction 9507. And even when we look at Appellate Exhibit 17, which was an excerpt from Air Force Instruction 9507, it talks in the initial paragraph under the section for commanders. It talks about squadron group and I think one other form of commanders. In that part, it talks about this: commanders have the authority to order these sorts of inspections, and they can order including vehicle examinations. And I'm paraphrasing a little bit there, but it talks about vehicle examinations. It doesn't distinguish between initial notifications or anything like that. It just says, commanders, you have this authority, and then it launches into a discussion of what is required for notification. So it's very holistic in terms of we have Air Force Instruction 9507 having consistency, Catano having consistency, and those two are consistent with each other, and then paragraph 4 of the installation commander's policy here is equally consistent with that. So it doesn't quite work to say that the installation commander did really mean to say all those things when they all fit together like that, and the installation commander evidently felt it was necessary to put that on the page.
Well, you would agree, though, that CAF has indicated that not every deviation from a policy is going to result in, should result in suppression of a test result, correct?
I would agree with that in the sense of but it depends on the type of the deviation. So Beckett, Strozier, and Pollard, those cases all do involve deviations, and as my colleague for the government pointed out, those do have to do with kind of how it's collected. But that's not having to do with deviation in terms of whether someone's ordered to do something. We see those sorts of deviations in Miller and Catano.
And there were no issues in this case with the procedures for collecting, transmitting, or testing the urine sample of appellees, correct?
There's not evidence of that, Your Honor, other than that's not challenged by trial defense counsel. And trial defense counsel equally conceded that paragraph 3 does apply to appellee. The issue really is whether or not the government followed the installation commander's policy.
Well, even for the subsequent test, that's the one that it's that question now that was suppressed. There were no issues with, again, the procedures for collecting, transmitting, or testing that sample either.
None of those were raised, but we also didn't reach litigation on that point. So maybe there would have been some issues. It wasn't to the degree where trial defense counsel sought to have them suppressed. And Beckett, Pollard, and Scherzer talk about it's a pretty high degree of deviation that we need to have in order to get to suppression on that basis. But those are also things that could potentially be fleshed out in terms of defenses, whether or not there's a chain of custody that's been followed or anything like that. So we didn't really reach that particular stage because there was suppression and then the government took up this appeal under Article 62. What we have, though, here is it just wasn't – the commander's policy was just not followed. And in particular, I even point the court all the way back to Bickel. Even Bickel, it talks about we need to have this clear, generally stated criterion. And those are the words that the Bickel case used to describe it. And we have multiple clear and generally stated criterions here, including paragraph 4, and we can't just excise that out. And Miller and Catano just reinforce that point. And one thing I'll turn to here is, there is the issue of burden of proof that's been raised by the government in the course of argument. For our view, the burden of proof really is kind of a side issue for this. Whether our position is that it's a clear and convincing burden, but ultimately the court doesn't even need to reach that issue because the facts are clear in this case. And even evaluating this based on the preponderance of the evidence standard, the evidence is still clear that the evidence from Lieutenant Bruno should have been suppressed and that the military judge properly suppressed it. Barring any further questions from the court, I have no further argument. Thank you.
Counsel?
Your Honor, I'll address a couple of arguments from my colleague. First, his argument equates to because OSI was the one to inform the unit of a mandatory policy issued by their wing commander that it apparently equates to a subterfuge. That's just not the case for multiple reasons. First of all, under the facts of this case, the military judge didn't find it was a subterfuge. The military judge found that all OSI did was inform them of a policy. Then, of course, you have the unit calling the squadron commander on the way there and telling them, we're on our way over because the wing commander has a policy that requires a Pele to retest. Once again, it's indistinguishable from OSI handing them the policy letter to telling them the policy requires them to retest. If it was a subterfuge, you would have expected the military judge to make such a finding, but the military judge didn't. The military judge's finding is based on this idea that there was a lack of command authority. My colleague also argued that Miller suggests that this was on autopilot. Well, I think the fact that the policy letter in this case exists distinguishes Miller, and Miller actually supports a finding that this case was an inspection. The one thing absent from Miller was a policy letter or command authority. We have that here. You heard about this clear criteria. Well, there was clear criteria. It's clear criteria for who gets inspected, and that is in the policy letter. An appellee fell within that criteria, as found by the military judge and conceded by my colleague. Miller, this court's decision in Miller and CAF's decision in Miller supports the idea that this was an inspection in this case. The one thing existed that the court identified in CAF that should have existed in that case, and that's the policy letter with the command authority inherent in it. I'd also like to identify that at no point has appellee identified what would have changed had he been given the written order. Effectively, the argument is there was a discrepancy, so suppression must occur. If that was the case, this court in Streetman would have suppressed the inspection because it had command directed at the top of it. That's just not the requirement. And Pollard and Bickle and all of those suggest it has to do with the reliability. Now, if there's a discrepancy to the point where it equates to no command authority, that's different, right? And I think that's where the military judge was kind of looking at because she erroneously interpreted the policy memo. But that's not the case here. The policy memo sets out the requirement and mandated a Pele retest. And that's why this is an incident of command.
Counsel, let me ask you. You say that there's been no evidence as to what would have been different. What is your position with regards to what violation of the process would have eliminated that command authority mechanism?
I think the absence of a policy memo or the policy memo was worded in a different way. I think with the policy memo comes, it was the wing commander that set the requirement for retesting. So that's where you go to look for the command authority for the inspection.
So you're saying that as long as there is a policy, you're always going to have the nexus to make a subsequent test part of that?
I'm not going to go that far, Your Honor, because we don't have to in this case. Because we know that the reason that he got to DDR was because of the policy. In other words, if a policy exists and let's say OSI doesn't know about it, and they just take him over or they just hand him to his first shirt, and no one's told that this policy exists. No one knows about it. And OSI, for some reason, tells the first shirt, like, take him over there for a health and welfare inspection. That's where you're going to run into a problem. I think we can just look at the facts of this case and see that we have a command policy. The reason he was there was because of the policy. And then when we look at the discrepancy in the framework that our Superior Court has given us, we come to our conclusion. I'd also like to point out that the notification here is not, there's no rights involved with it. There's nothing to do with due process. You haven't heard that argument from appellee that he's afforded rights. LeBlanc wasn't cited to this court, but you see it in the military judge's ruling. It was argued at trial. Trial counsel supplied it in an email supplemental cite that was made an appellate exhibit. And that LeBlanc goes through the framework of, does a regulation or a requirement create due process rights. In other words, are there things in there that, and you see that framework here, none of that applies. Like I said, it was just a process. Finally, and I see I'm running out of time, but the burden of proof requires this reversal. It tainted the military judge's ruling throughout it. It's the lens with which we view the facts, the legal issues. That alone requires suppression. And if there are no further questions from the court, may I briefly conclude?
You may.
The policy letter executed by the 2nd Bomb Wing CC mandated appellee submit a follow-on your analysis sample, as he tested positive for a controlled substance with no legal justification. Appellee went to DDR and submitted a second urine sample because of the policy. The policy was the reason he was there. It follows that appellee's follow-on urine analysis was conducted as an incident of command. Any deviation on policy had no impact on the collection, processing, testing, no relation to the reliability or privacy protections, etc. Reversal of the military judge's suppression ruling is necessary. Thank you.
Counsel, thank you both for your arguments. We will render a decision in due course. The court is now closed.